Chapter 16. Pitt went out on deck and looked up at the mast light as it swayed back and forth across the Milky Way. He planted his arms on the railing and gazed across the water at the island of Corregidor as the Oregon sailed out of Manila Bay. The indefinable black mass rose from the night, guarding the entrance to the bay in tomb-like silence. A few lights glimmered on the interior of the island, along with red warning lights on a transmitter tower. It was difficult for Pitt to imagine the onslaught of death and destruction that inundated the rocky outcropping during the war years. The number of men who died there, Americans in 1942, Japanese in 1945, numbered in the thousands. A small village of huts sat near the decaying dock, from which General Douglas MacArthur had boarded Commander Buckley's torpedo boat for the initial stage of his journey to Australia and later return. Pitt smelled the pungent odor of cigar smoke and turned as a crewman moved beside him at the railing. Under the running lights, Pitt could see a man who was in his late 50s. He recognized Max Hanley, who had been introduced earlier, not as the chief engineer or first officer, but as the corporate vice president in charge of operational systems. Once safely out to sea, Hanley, like the rest of the dedicated crew members, transformed himself into a different person by donning comfortably casual clothes better suited for a golf course. He wore sneakers and was dressed in white shorts and a maroon polo shirt. He held a cup of coffee in one hand. His skin was reddened, with no trace of tan, the brown eyes alert, a bulbous nose and only a wisp of auburn hair splayed across his head. "A lot of history in that old rock," said Hanley. "I always come topside when we slip past her." "She's pretty quiet now," replied Pitt. "My father died over there in 42 when the big gun he was manning took a direct hit from a Japanese bomber. A lot of good men died with him." "That they did." Hanley looked into Pitt's eyes. "I'll be directing the descent into the water and retrieval of your submersible. Anything me or my engineers can help you with in regard to your equipment and electronics, you just holler." "There is something."
"Name it."
"Could your crew do a quick repaint of the Sea Dog 2? The Pneuma Turquoise trademark color is highly visible in shallow water from the surface."
"What color would you like?"
asked Hanley. "A medium green," explained Pitt. "A shade that blends with the water in the harbor."
"I'll get my boys on it first thing."
Hanley turned and leaned against the rail with his back, staring up at the wisp of smoke drifting from the ship's funnel.
"Seems to me it might have been a whole lot simpler to use one of them underwater robotic vehicles."
"Or an autonomous underwater vehicle," said Pitt, smiling. "Neither would prove as efficient as a manned submersible for inspecting the bottom of a hull the size of the United States. The sub's manipulator arm may also prove useful. There are certain projects where human eyesight is advantageous over video cameras. This happens to be one of them." Hanley read the dial of an old pocket watch whose chain was hooked to a belt loop. "Time to program the engine and navigation systems. Now that we've reached open water, the chairman will want to triple our speed." "We must be doing close to 9 or 10 knots now," said Pitt. His curiosity piqued.
"Strictly a performance," Hanley said candidly. "Whenever the old Oregon is in sight of prying eyes around the harbor or other ships that pass at sea, we like to make her look as if her antique engines and screws are straining to make headway. Which is the way she should appear for an old tub. In truth, she's been modified with 2 screws turned by twin diesel turbine engines that can push her past 40 knots. But with a full load of cargo, your hull is riding low in the water and causing a heavy drag."
Hanley tilted his head toward the cargo hatches and the wooden crates tied to the deck. "All empty. We ride low because we fill specially installed ballast tanks to give the appearance of a heavily laden ship.
Once they're pumped out, she'll rise 6 feet and take off 4 times faster than when she was built. A fox in disguise. With the teeth to match? Ask Chairman Cabrillo to show you how we bite back if we're attacked. I'll do that. Good night, Mr. Pitt. Good night, Mr. Hanley. 10 minutes later, Pitt felt the ship come to life as the vibrations from the engines increased dramatically. The wake turned from a white, spreading scar to a boiling cauldron. The stern sank by a good 3 feet, the bow raised in an equal proportion and creamed white. The water rushed along the hull as if swept away by a giant broom. The sea shimmered under an awning of stars that outlined a scattering of thunderclouds on the horizon. It was a postcard South China Sea evening, with an orange-tinted sky to the west. The Oregon approached the outer reaches of Hong Kong Harbor 2 days later, making landfall at sunset. She had made the crossing from Manila in remarkable time. Twice, upon meeting other freighters during daylight, Cabrillo gave the order for slow speed. Several of the crew, always quickly dressed in their shabby coveralls, assembled on deck and peered across the gap between the passing ships, staring blankly at what Cabrillo called a show of dummies. In an unwritten tradition of the sea, the crews of overtaking or passing ships coming together at sea never showed any animation. Only their eyeballs moved and blinked. Passengers wave, but merchant seamen always act uneasy when looking at crewmen on another ship. Usually, they offer a stiff little wave from a hand draped over the rail before disappearing inside their ship. Once the strange vessel was a safe distance in the Oregon's wake, Cabrillo ordered a return to fast cruising speed. Pitt and Giordino were given a tour of the remarkable ship. The wheelhouse above the aft house, or superstructure, was kept in a grimy and dirty state to mislead visiting port officials and harbor pilots. The unused officer and crew quarters below the wheelhouse were also kept in a slovenly mess to avoid suspicion. There was, however, no way of masquerading the engine room to make it look like a scrap heap. Vice President Hanley wouldn't hear of it. If any customs or harbor inspector came on board and wanted to see his engines, Hanley fixed up a passageway with enough dirty oil and sludge covering the deck and bulkheads to discourage even the most zealous officials from wanting to enter. None ever realized that the hatch beyond the filthy passageway opened onto an engine room as immaculate as a hospital's operating room. The actual officer and crew cabins were concealed under the cargo holds. For defense, the Oregon fairly bristled with weaponry. Like the German raiders of both wars and the British Q-ships of World War I, whose sides dropped away to reveal 6-inch guns and vicious torpedo tubes, the Oregon's hull secreted an array of sea-to-sea and sea-to-air missile launchers. The ship was remarkably different from any whose decks Pitt had set foot on before. It was a masterwork of deception and fabrication. He suspected there was no other like it on the seas. He ate an early dinner with Giordino before going to the wheelhouse for a conference with Cabrillo. He was introduced to the ship's chef, Marie Dugard, a lady from Belgium with credentials that would send any restaurant or hotel owner on his knees, begging her to work as his chef de cuisine. She was on board the Oregon because Cabrillo made her an offer she couldn't refuse. Through wise investments of her considerable fee as the ship's chef, she planned on opening her own restaurant in Midtown Manhattan after 2 more undercover operations. The menu was extraordinary. Giordino's taste buds were mundane, so he settled for the bœuf à la mode, braised beef covered with aspic and glazed vegetables. Pitt opted for riz de veau ou cervelle au beurre noir, sweetbreads in brown butter sauce, served with baked mushroom caps, stuffed with crab, enhanced by a boiled artichoke with hollandaise sauce. He allowed the chef to select for him a fine 1992 Ferrari Carano Sienna from Sonoma County. Pitt could not boast of having eaten a more savory meal, and certainly not on board a ship such as the Oregon. After an espresso, Pitt and Giordino took a companionway up to the wheelhouse. Here, pipes and iron fittings were stained with rust. Paint was flaking from bulkheads and window frames. The deck was deeply marred and spotted with old cigarette burns. Very little equipment seemed up to date. Only the brass on the old-fashioned binnacle and telegraph gleamed under the antiquated light fixtures still containing 60-watt bulbs. Chairman Cabrillo was standing on a bridge wing, pipe firmly clamped between his teeth. The ship had entered the West Lama Channel, leading to Hong Kong Harbor. Traffic was heavy, and Cabrillo ordered slow speed in preparation of taking on the harbor pilot. Her ballast tanks refilled when 20 miles out, the Oregon looked like any one of 100 old freighters fully laden with cargo entering the busy harbor. The ruby lights on the television and microwave antennas atop Mount Victoria blinked on and off as a warning to low-flying aircraft. The thousands of lights decorating the palatial jumbo floating restaurant near Aberdeen on Hong Kong Island sprinkled the water like clouds of fireflies. If there was any risk and danger attached to the planned covert activity, the men and officers congregated in the wheelhouse demonstrated an utter immunity to it. The chart room and the deck around the helm had become a corporate boardroom. The merits of different Asian stocks and bonds were being weighed. They were savvy investors who followed the market with seemingly more interest than they showed for the coming spy job on the United States. Cabrillo stepped in from the bridge wing, noticed Pitt and Giordino, and approached them. "My friends in Hong Kong have informed me that the United States is tied up at Tsim Sha Maritime's terminal dock at Kwai Chung north of Kowloon. The proper harbor officials have been bribed, and we've been given a berth in the channel about 500 yards from the liner." "A 1,000-yard round trip," said Pitt, mentally calculating the submersible's downtime. "Sea Dog 2's batteries, how far can you stretch them?" asked Cabrillo. 14 hours if we treat them gently," replied Giordino. "Can you be towed behind a launch while underwater and out of sight?" Pitt nodded. "A tow to and from would give us an extra hour under the liner's hull. I must warn you, though, the submersible is no lightweight. Its underwater drag will make ponderous going for a small launch." Cabrillo smiled evenly. "You don't know what type of engines power our shore launch and lifeboats." "I'm not even going to ask," said Pitt. "But I'm guessing they could hold their own in a Gold Cup hydro race." "We've given away enough of the Oregon's technical secrets for you to write a book on her." Cabrillo turned and peered through the bridge window as the pilot boat came out from the harbor, made a 180-degree turn, and came alongside. The ladder was dropped, and the pilot stepped from his boat and climbed to the deck while both vessels were still underway. He went directly to the bridge, greeted Cabrillo, and took charge of the helm. Pitt walked outside onto the bridge wing and viewed the incredible carnival of colored lights of Kowloon and Hong Kong as the ship slipped through the channel to her assigned anchorage northwest of the Central Harbor. Along the waterfront of Victoria Harbor, the skyscrapers were illuminated like a forest of giant Christmas trees. In appearance, the city had changed little after it was taken over in 1997 by the People's Republic of China. For most of the residents, life went on as before. It was the wealthy, along with many of the giant corporations, who had moved, primarily to the west coast of the United States. He was joined by Giordino as the ship closed on Tsim Sha's dock terminal, the transatlantic ocean liner that was once the pride of America's maritime fleet, appeared and grew larger. During the flight to Manila, He and Giordino had studied a lengthy report on the United States. The brainchild of the famed ship designer William Francis Gibbs, she was built by the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company, who laid her keel in 1950. Gibbs, a genius and a genuine character, was to marine engineering and design what Frank Lloyd Wright was to dryland architecture. His dream was to create the fastest and most beautiful passenger liner yet built. He achieved his dream, and his masterpiece became the pride and apex of America during the age of great liners. She was truly the ultimate in elegant refinement and speed. Gibbs was fanatical about weight and fireproofing. He insisted on using aluminum whenever possible. From the 1.2 million rivets driven into her hull to the lifeboats and their oars, stateroom furnishings and bathroom fixtures, babies' high chairs, even coat hangers and picture frames, all had to be aluminum. The only wood on the entire ship was a fireproof Steinway piano and the chef's butcher block. In the end, Gibbs had reduced the weight of the superstructure by 2,500 tons. The result was a ship of remarkable stability. Considered huge then, and now with a gross tonnage of 53,329, and measuring 990 feet in length with a 101-foot beam, she was not the world's largest liner. At the time of her construction, the Queen Mary outweighed her by over 30,000 tons, and the Queen Elizabeth was 41 feet longer. The Cunard Line Queens may have provided a more ornate and baroque atmosphere, but the American ship's lack of rich wood paneling and fancy decor, in favor of tasteful restraint, and her speed and safety were the elements that set the United States apart from her contemporaries. Unlike foreign competing liners, the Big U, as her crew had affectionately called her, gave her passengers 694 unusually spacious staterooms and air conditioning. 19 elevators carried passengers between the decks. Besides the usual gift shops, they could enjoy 3 libraries and 2 cinemas, and could worship in a chapel. But her 2 greatest assets were a military secret at the time of her building and operation. Not until several years later did it become known that she could be converted into a military transport capable of carrying 14,000 troops within a few weeks. Powered by 8 massive boilers creating superheated steam, her 4 Westinghouse geared turbines could put out 240,000 horsepower, 60,000 for each of her 4 propeller shafts, and drive her through the water just under 50 miles an hour. She was one of the few liners that could slip through the Panama Canal, charge across the Pacific to Singapore and back to San Francisco without refueling. In 1952, the United States won the prestigious Blue Ribbon, awarded for the fastest speed across the Atlantic. No liner has won it since. A decade after she left the shipyard, she had become an anachronism. Commercial airplanes were already becoming competition to the famed Greyhounds of the sea. By 1969, rising operating costs and the public's desire to reach their destination in the shortest time possible by air spelled the end for America's greatest ocean liner. She was retired and laid up for 30 years at Norfolk, Virginia, before eventually finding her way to China. Borrowing a pair of binoculars, Pitt studied the huge ship from the bridge of the Oregon. Her hull was still painted black, her superstructure white, her 2 great, magnificent funnels red, white, and blue. She looked as magnificent as the day she broke the transatlantic record. He was puzzled to see her ablaze with light. The sounds of activity echoed across the water. It puzzled him that Chin Chang's shipyard crews were working on her around the clock without any attempt at secrecy. Then, curiously, all sounds and activity suddenly stopped. The pilot nodded at Cabrillo, who rang the ancient telegraph to stop engines. Unknown to the pilot, the telegraph was non-functional, and Cabrillo muttered orders through a handheld radio. The vibration died, and the Oregon went as quiet as a tomb as she slowly moved forward under her own momentum. Then the command came for slow astern, followed shortly by all stop. Cabrillo gave the order to let go the anchor. The chain rattled, and it fell with a splash into the water. Then he shook hands with the pilot after signing the usual affidavits and logging the mooring. He waited until the pilot was on board the pilot boat before motioning to Pitt and Giordino. "Come join me in the chart room and we'll go over tomorrow's program." "Why wait another 24 hours?" asked Giordino. Cabrillo shook his head. "Tomorrow after dark is soon enough. We still have customs officials due aboard. No sense in alerting suspicions." Pitt said, "I think we have a breakdown in communications." Cabrillo looked at him. "You see a problem?" "We have to go during daylight. We have no visibility at night." "Can't you use underwater lights?" "In black water, any bright light stands out like a beacon. We'd be discovered 10 seconds after we switched on our floods." "We'll be inconspicuous when we're under the keel," Giordino added. "It's when we're inspecting the hull on the sides below the waterline that we're vulnerable to detection from above." "What about the darkness caused by the shadow of the hull?" asked Cabrillo. "What if underwater visibility is lousy? What then?" "We'd have to rely on artificial lighting, but it would be imperceptible to anyone staring over the side of the dock with sun over their head." Cabrillo nodded. "I understand your dilemma. Romantic adventure novels say it's darkest before dawn. We'll drop you and your submersible over the side and tow you within spitting distance of the United States, putting you on station before sunup." "Sounds good to me," Pitt said gratefully. "Can I ask you a question, Mr. Chairman?" inquired Giordino. "Go right ahead." "If you carry no cargo, how do you justify entering and exiting a port?" Cabrillo gave Giordino a canny look. "The empty wooden crates you see on the deck and the ones in the cargo holds above our concealed cabins and galley are stage props. They will be offloaded onto the dock, then consigned to an agent who works for me and transported to a warehouse. After a proper length of time, the crates are remarked with different descriptions, returned to the dock, and loaded back on board. As far as the Chinese are concerned, we dumped one cargo and took on another." "Your operation never ceases to amaze," said Pitt. "You were given a tour of our computer compartment in the bow of the ship," said Cabrillo. "So you know that 90% of the Oregon's operation is under the command of computer automated systems. We go manual when entering and departing a port." Pitt handed the binoculars to Cabrillo. "You're an old pro at stealth and covert activities. Doesn't it strike you odd that Chin Shang is converting the United States into a first-class smuggler's transport, right out in the open, under the eyes of anyone looking on? Crewmen on cargo ships, passengers on ferries and tour boats?" "It does seem peculiar," Cabrillo admitted. He lowered the glasses momentarily in thought, puffed on his pipe, and peered through the lenses again. "It's also peculiar that all work on the ship appears to have stopped. No sign of tight security, either." "Tell you anything?" asked Giordino. "It either tells Chin Shang is uncommonly careless, or our renowned intelligence agencies have been outsmarted by him," said Cabrillo quietly. "We'll know better after we check out the ship's bottom," said Pitt. "If he intends to smuggle illegal aliens into foreign countries under the noses of their immigration officials, he'd have to have a technique for removing them off the ship undetected. That can only mean some kind of watertight passage beneath the waterline to shore, or even possibly a submarine." Cabrillo tapped his pipe on the rail, watching as the ashes spiraled down into the harbor. Then he looked thoughtfully across the water at the former pride of America's passenger fleet, her superstructure and two rakish funnels brilliantly lit like a movie set. When he spoke, it was slowly and solemnly. "You fully realize, I assume, that if something should go wrong, a minor mishap, an overlooked detail, and you are caught in what is considered an act of espionage by the People's Republic of China, you will be treated accordingly."
"Like being tortured and shot," said Giordino.
Cabrillo nodded. "And without anyone in our government so much as lifting their little finger to stop the execution."
"Al and I are fully aware of the consequences," said Pitt. "But you're placed in the hazardous position of risking your entire crew and your ship. I wouldn't fault you for a second if you wanted to toss us in the bay and steam off into the sunset."
Cabrillo stared at him and smiled craftily.
"Are you serious? Skip out on you?
I'd never consider it.
Certainly not for the enormous sum of money a certain secret government fund is paying me and the crew. As far as I'm concerned, this has far less risk than robbing a bank."
"In excess of 7 figures?" Pitt asked.
"More like 8, replied Cabrillo, suggesting a fee of over $10 million.
Giordino looked over at Pitt sadly.
"When I think of what our pitiful monthly stipend from Numa adds up to, I can't help wondering where we went wrong."